All right, so you should be catching on by now that I'm going to test you over what we've been talking about. Who can tell me what one of the ingredients of a biblical worldview is? There's three major ingredients. One of the ingredients of a biblical worldview. Yes. Yes, there's a big story. And what grows out of that big story? Don't be shy. Somebody saying it? Yes. Go ahead. Say again, Bill. Yes, your cultural action is the end result, and there's something that comes in between your big story of the world. It grows out of your big story, and it ends up in your cultural behavior. Your cultural behavior comes from your beliefs and values. All right, you guys have to get this down, because if there's any one thing that you learn by the end of the summer, you should know the three ingredients of a biblical worldview. Your big story of the world, your beliefs and values that grow out of that big story, and the cultural action that results from those beliefs and values. All right, one more test question. The big story of the world has three parts to it. And again, if there's one thing that you learn this summer, you should know the three parts to the big story. What are the three parts of the big story of Scripture? And Dennis covered one of them last week. I'll cover one this week, and Dennis will cover another one next week. Does somebody have at least one, David? Creation, yes. And what happens after creation? Fall. And what happens after the fall? Redemption, that's our hope. So creation, fall, redemption is the big story of the world. Now, I could make you memorize this phrase. I'll just have you think about it. But if you were to witness to somebody who had no idea what the Bible was, they tell you the Bible is such a huge, overwhelming book. It's confusing. It has all these random stories in it. I don't get it. I don't understand it. You can simply, in one sentence, explain to them what the Bible is with the creation, fall, redemption big story in mind. You should tell them that the Bible is the true story. It's not just a story that we make up. It's a true story about what? It's a true story of what God is doing. God is the central character of that story. The Bible is the true story of what God is doing to do what? To glorify himself. Ultimately, the story is all about God and his glory. God's glory is more important than anything else in this story. So the Bible is the true story of what God is doing to glorify himself. And how does he glorify himself? Well, at least one of the major ways that God glorifies himself is by redeeming his fallen creation. You see the creation, fall, redemption there? By redeeming his fallen creation. Redeeming basically means that he's restoring what has been broken, that he originally created as perfect and good. He has a plan to restore it, to fix it. So the Bible is the true story of what God is doing to glorify himself by redeeming his fallen creation. It's a lot packed into one sentence, but in one sentence you can tell somebody what the Bible is all about. And every single individual story plugs into that one big story of creation, fall, redemption. No story in the Bible is just random and just there for no reason. It all plugs into that big story. The Bible is the true story of what God is doing to glorify himself by redeeming his fallen creation. So maybe next week, somebody can tell me what the Bible is the true story of. Maybe we'll go over it again. I don't know. We'll see. All right, so let's move on to what we're doing this week. Last week, Dennis introduced the beliefs and values that arise out of the creation part of the story. And this week, we'll talk about the beliefs and values that arise out of the fall part of the story. And then next week, Dennis will talk about the beliefs and values that arise out of the redemption part of the story. And all of these beliefs and values have implications for our cultural engagements, our personal behavior in all the different spheres of our world that we live in. And we'll get to a few of those at the end of the summer. We'll talk about gender and family, and then we'll talk about science, and we'll talk about some of the implications that creation, fall, redemption has on some of the disciplines. In our worldview book, we have other disciplines like history, government, culture and the arts. We won't have time to get to those units, but we'll try to summarize the unit on the fall here today. And let me just show you what the three chapters are in that unit on the fall. The first one is about as far as the curse is found. And the second one is about common grace, the world and you. And the third one is about a paradigm that we call structure and direction. So thinking about some of the implications that the fall has here, first of all, the extent of the curse should impact, you know, how far is the curse found in this world? The extent of the curse should impact how we think of and how we interact with every single cultural artifact. A cultural artifact is anything that anybody makes, anything that anybody does, any kind of institution in this world. The extent of the fall, the extent of the curse, should impact how we think about everything in culture. How is it affected by the fall and how far the fall extends? On the other hand, with common grace, that should impact us. We shouldn't be overly pessimistic, thinking, well, everything has been affected by the fall, so therefore we reject everything. No, common grace, God's restraint, allows us to have a little bit more of a positive outlook on culture, what we can do with culture, what unbelievers do with culture, even though we have to evaluate everything because of the extent of the fall, because the curse is as far as creation is. And another implication is that we need to consider is the structure and direction. There needs to be a good model of discernment. Since the curse has affected everything, we need to analyze and evaluate it, be careful about it. But there's goodness that still exists because of common grace. Well, then what is a good model for doing that evaluation? So that's just a big overview of what this whole entire unit is about on fall. So let's look at the first chapter, which is as far as the curse is found. And let me just summarize this first chapter, what it's all about. Since the fall extends to every aspect of creation and culture, the academic disciplines, the cultural domains that we discussed earlier with sphere sovereignty, these are not neutral. Nothing is neutral in this world. If you presuppose that things are, well, things are basically good or things are neutral, then it's not coming from a biblical worldview. Everything has been affected by the fall. It's been twisted. So this means that the Christian perspective on every aspect of life needs to rebuild these fallen disciplines, these fallen institutions. And that's what we'll talk about next week when Dennis gets to redemption. So the first thing that we need to consider when we talk about the fall is the personal effects of the fall, the effects of the fall that happens to us as people. And this is probably what you're most familiar with, and I'm just going to pull up all the slides here and walk right through everything on this slide. The personal effects of the fall means, well, think back to Genesis 3. What was the first effect of the fall that you see in Genesis 3? Adam and Eve realize that they are naked, which they were before in their innocent state, but now there's something else that accompanies their realization, and that's shame. So the first effect of the fall, although the fall is something that happened to them inward, like it's spiritual, right? The first effect of the fall was something that was external, something about their physicality. And it's a symptom. It's their guilt and shame. In fact, if you want to prove to somebody that the world is a fallen place, that and that there's a spiritual problem, what is the evidence that we have a spiritual problem that cuts us off from God? It's the physical effects of the fall. You look at the broken world and us as people, us being broken, you say, there's certainly a problem here. This isn't the way it was supposed to be. And I think Dennis was asking me about this before. What's the big difference between us and the evolutionary worldview? Well, they want to try to indoctrinate people into thinking that death and suffering and all these effects, all the evidence around them, that it's always been. So a big debate between the Christian worldview and the evolutionary worldview is death and suffering the way it's supposed to be? They would say yes. We would say no, that death is an intrusion. And there are symptoms that we can see, and some of those symptoms would be our guilt and shame. And, of course, there's the death of our outer man, which is the separation of the body from the soul, but there's also the inner death, the separation of us from God. And really, that's the cause of all the symptoms of the problems that we see in our physical world. And if you think about the personal effects of the fall and the extent of it, as far as the curse is found, not only does it affect every person, Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, but it affects every part of every person. Now, this does not mean that people are always as bad as they could possibly be, that they always sin in the worst possible way, because, again, we'll look at common grace in the next chapter. But what it does mean is that every part of a person is affected. It's not just their thinking that's affected, where some people say, well, if we could just educate them, if people just got a better education, if we just told them the truth, well, people reject the truth. They don't want to submit to the truth because there's more problems than just their thinking. It's their affections. In fact, one of the big points that we make in the chapter, in one of these chapters, is that affection drives cognition. Cognition is simply a fancy word for saying your thinking, your mind, your affections. Now, what are affections? Affections is not synonymous with emotions. We're not saying that your emotions drive your thinking. That's not what we're saying. Your affections is kind of like the direction that you're pointed in. Before you're saved, you're going in one direction. After you're saved, you're going 180 degrees in the opposite direction. Your affections is like the needle. Which way are you pointing? And if you're pointing towards God and the treasure of your heart, your desires, your delights, if those affections are pointed towards God, then that should drive your thinking. That should drive your choices. That should drive your feelings, your emotions. If your affections are bent towards ungodliness, your flesh, which is what the natural man is bent towards, then his affections, his desires, his delights, the treasure in his heart is going to affect his thinking, the way he evaluates the evidence, his choices that he makes, his ethics, his morals, and his feelings. So the affections are the most important part. Now, of course, we renew our minds with the Word of God, and that should restore in us the right affections. So there is an interplay that goes back and forth, but you can logically see in one way that your affection drives your cognition, your thinking. And the real problem with affections is that every person, again, we're talking about the extent of the fall here, every person is enslaved to sin, to their flesh, their affections, the treasure box of their heart is enslaved. And what happens when we are saved is that we are no longer enslaved, which doesn't mean that we can't sin. It means that we're not obligated to sin. Think of it this way. If you were renting an apartment and you have somebody who owns that apartment complex and you owe money every month to the person who owns the apartment complex, well, what happens if the owner changes? The original owner, he gets bought out and somebody else owns the apartment complex. Are you supposed to pay the guy who no longer owns the apartment? No, that would be stupid to pay him. He doesn't own it. That's not where rent is due. You can be stupid and pay him money, but there's a new owner, and you are supposed to, you know, owe him or walk worthy of him if you're making the illustration to Christ. We are no longer enslaved to our flesh, the devil. We are now obligated to our Lord, our Savior. He's our master. But we are foolish, aren't we? We often pay rent to our flesh when we shouldn't have to. So what is the remedy for the personal effects? And again, I'm just going to pull it all up here so you can see it. The remedy is our union with Christ. And there is a real danger that has been noted by other biblical scholars recently, that we tend to go from one pendulum to another pendulum in what we emphasize in our theology. There was a time when a lot of people wrongly just emphasized morals. And not that morals are wrong, but they brought to the forefront how we should live. And they disconnected how we should live from what gives us the power to live that way. They disconnected Christian living from the gospel. So there's been a really, really strong emphasis on getting back to the gospel. The gospel, the gospel, the gospel is the foundation for everything. And we don't want to go away from the emphasis of the gospel. But some people have boiled down sanctification to nothing more than thinking positive thoughts about the gospel. Sanctification is a lot more than just thinking positive about the gospel. There's two parts of our union with Christ. One is justification. We are declared righteous. That's our salvation. That's the root and foundation and basis of everything. But our union with Christ is more than just our justification, what we're declared to be. Our union with Christ does something to us. It makes us alive so that we can walk worthy of who Christ is. And there's a responsive participation in the gospel. Philippians 2, 12 and 13. I don't have it memorized off the top of my head, but it's basically that God is the one who empowers us to will and to do of his good pleasure. He gives us the will, the desire to do what's right and to actually carry out that, the will and to do of his good pleasure. And so both aspects of union with Christ are extremely important, not just what God has done to justify us, to declare us righteous, but also that he's changed us. He's made us alive. That means that our affections should turn from idolatry to a new master. And if our affections have turned from idolatry to a new master, then that should affect our mind. We should be renewing our minds. We should hunger and thirst after righteousness. And through the washing of the word, it should turn us away from our sin, our actual practice in life. And if our minds have been renewed, then it should lead us to making good choices, loving God and fearing God. And if you love God and fear God, then that's what produces obedience. And if you love and fear God and you obey him, because that's exactly what he designed you. He designed you to love him and fear him. And if we're doing what he designed us to do, then we should have the emotions of joy. And when God is glorified, that's what we were designed and created for God to be glorified. And if we're functioning the way God designed us to function, then that's when we can have joy. So one follows from the other. Now, most of the time when we talk about the fall, we think of the personal effects of the fall, how it affects me as a person and my relationship with God. But you realize that God gave us a task, right? We're not only created in God's image, but we were given the creation mandate. The creation mandate is to fill the earth and to subdue the earth, to develop it. And when Adam fell into sin, he not only affected himself and all of the people that would extend from him in their personhood, but he affected the world around him. And that's what we mean by cosmic. The whole entire world has been affected by the fall. The tasks that the humans were given were affected. I don't have time to read this. Maybe Dennis will get to it next week because I know he talks about it in the redemption unit. But Romans 8, 18 through 23 talks about the whole earth is groaning. The whole earth has been subjected to futility. So it's not just we as humans, one part of creation that's been affected by the fall, but it's been all of creation that has been affected by the fall. And as Dennis will talk about next week, redemption is restoration. What will be restored? It's not just us that's going to be restored. It's all of God's good creation is going to be restored. Now, if the whole creation has been affected by the fall, and you remember we talked about culture and what culture is. Culture is simply the carrying out of the creation mandate. When you fill the earth and when you subdue the earth, when you develop the earth, what are you doing? When you develop the earth, you are fulfilling the creation mandate. What are you going to produce when you develop the earth? You're going to produce culture. Now, if all the earth has suffered from the effects of the fall, all of our natural resources, all of our capacities, everything that we do, what is culture? Culture is nothing more than group behavior. So if all of us are personally affected and all of the world has been affected by the fall, then all of culture has been affected by the fall. There is no one part of culture that is neutral or just naturally good. Everything has been affected by the fall. So when you think of all the academic disciplines, when you think of all of the institutions on earth, the family, government, culture and the arts, everything has been affected by the fall. Now, this means that we have two responses that we need to avoid. First of all, we need to avoid isolation. We talked about the two-story view, separating the sacred and the secular. And it's a mistake to think that you can find some compartment in life that's sacred and that has not been affected by the fall. So we all live and breathe in this church, right? The fall doesn't affect this church, right? Yeah, you guys have been around long enough. There is no one place that has been sectored off from the fall, no institution, because what populates every single institution in the world? Fallen people are fathers and mothers in the family. Fallen people are children in the family. Fallen people are pastors in the church. Fallen people are congregations in the church. Fallen people are teachers in the schools. Fallen people are those who write the curriculum, including the biblical worldview curriculum at the press is affected by the fall. Believe me, there are disagreements on how we should write things. The fall affects everything. There is no compartment that is free from the fall. So we have to avoid thinking, oh, we can isolate ourselves into a sacred compartment and pietistically escape and be above all the fallenness of this world. The sinful nature is never eradicated. It's never cut out from any one of us, even after salvation. We always have a battle between the spirit and the flesh, even as believers. It's not until glorification, when we're taken to heaven, that we are free from the effects of the fall. And the same thing being said, the opposite ditch is we have to be careful of worldliness. If everything has been affected by the fall, and no one part of our world and culture is free from fallenness, then we have to be careful of imitating the world. Worldliness is basically group behavior that's bent away from God's design. We have to be both salt and light. This is where it takes discernment on how we respond to our world, because we can't say, well, I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to discern it. I'll just sector myself off and isolate myself, and then I don't have to deal with this. You'll always find fallenness wherever you go, because fallenness is within you. And at the same time, when you look around you, you have to be careful of what you're imbibing in, what you're accepting, because everything in culture has been tainted by the fall. Now that brings us to common grace. We don't want to be too pessimistic because of what God has done. Let me just summarize this chapter on common grace. Even though the fall has twisted every aspect of creation and culture, the image of God and his common grace ensure that the goodness of creation is not completely destroyed. That means that even non-Christians can make useful cultural contributions. However, the reality must be balanced with the real danger of being conformed to the world. The reason intelligent people who contribute to culture hold to false worldviews is that their affection drives their cognition, which we already talked about. I'm going to go through this real fast because I'm running out of time. But there are two things that are extremely important to understand when we get into, especially the gender unit. We talk about homosexuality and such. You have to understand original sin and common grace and how they work together. Original sin is the guilt that is put on our account. That's what imputed means. The guilt that is put on our account because of the way that we're conceived in sin. We're corrupt. We have corrupt natures as we're born and when we're conceived. And that's inherited from Adam. So a simple way of saying this is that we sin because we're sinners. It's because of who we are that leads to our sin. It's not that we sin and, oh, now you're a sinner. No, we're sinners. That's who we are. That's how we were conceived. And that's why we sin. So somebody can be born and feel or think that they have a tendency towards homosexuality, which we'll talk about in a few weeks. Well, yeah, I can see that people are born with those feelings because of original sin. But there's also common grace. Is everybody born with the same bent towards sin and the same kinds of particular sins? Well, there's various restraints on sin. So common grace is God's favor. It's his promotion of all that is good, even for the unbeliever, and it's his restraint of sin in the lives of even unbelievers. I'm just going to go through this very quickly. Culture is simply group behavior. And if a culture has been highly influenced by a biblical worldview, then you may have some cultures that are closer to God's design and some cultures that are further away from God's design, which really blows out of the water multiculturalism, which is every culture is basically good and neutral. We should just accept them all. That's actually an unbiblical worldview. There are some cultures that have a larger amount of common grace because they have a larger amount of Christian influence, whether that's actual true believers or if it's biblical principles that unbelievers borrow from, and therefore you have some cultures that have more common grace, more truth, goodness, and beauty in what it produces and how its institutions operate. And of course, I don't have any time to get into this, but there's always the danger of worldliness on the one hand and asceticism, which is withdrawing from the world on the other hand. Our responsibility in the world is to be pilgrims. We are not of this world. Be careful of worldliness. But also ambassadors. Be representatives. That's just another way of saying be salt and light. And I have about 1 minute here to go through this last thing. Structure and direction. This is the paradigm that we use. And this is just another way of saying creation, fall, redemption. The middle one is the structure. That's the way that God designed the world to function. And that's creation. Direction can go in one of two ways. It can go in the bad way, fallen way, where people are pulling away from God's creational design, and that's the fall. And then there's others who are taking what's been bent away from God's creational design, and they're trying to push it back into its structural design, the way God made it to be, and that's redemption. Living in light of redemption, or living faithfully, living redemptively. And I really don't have time to talk about that paradigm at all, but it's a helpful paradigm to think through. In our culture engagement, what we're trying to do is understand what is creational, what is God's structure, how has it been bent in the wrong direction, and how can we bend it back into God's structural design. All right, so I'll have Dennis come on up and answer all your questions.